Without further ado, I would like to introduce our speaker for this evening. We're delighted to have Professor Alistair McGrath with us tonight. He is the Professor of Science and Religion here at the University of Oxford, and he is the author of a recent biography of C.S. Lewis. And he will speak for about 45 minutes, and then we will have a Q&A. So, Professor McGrath.
Good. Well, thank you very much, and it's a very great pleasure to be here. And let me welcome you to, or welcome you back to Oxford, and I very much hope this will be a very important and significant time in your lives. And I thought it would be good to begin this new academic year by talking a bit about C.S. Lewis. Why C.S. Lewis? Well, one, I know a bit about him, which is always a good idea if you're talking about him. But secondly, I think he is a very good role model for anybody who's trying to develop the life of the mind. And what I want to do is look at some of the themes that Lewis develops and see whether these actually make sense to you, whether these help you think things through. And if we want to begin, I think a very good biblical text is this. It's our Lord's summary of the Ten Commandments. It's the summary of the first commandment. You love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, with all your mind. And that's something I think you want to underscore. Yes, there's a discipleship of the hands where you go and do things. Yes, there's a discipleship of the heart where you try and love God more. But there's also a discipleship of the mind. And that really means saying, look, I got to think about my faith. I want to really make connections between my faith and what I'm doing in my disciplines and try and enlarge my vision of what the Christian faith is all about and make sure I can give some good answers to the kind of questions that people are asking around me. And of course, we might think also of this very helpful verse in Romans 12, where Paul is talking about the practical business of Christian living. And he says, don't be conformed to this world. In other words, don't passively echo what the world is saying, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds. I think that's a very important theme. When I came up to Oxford here, I was an undergraduate at Wadham College, and I arrived in October 1971. Now, that was quite a long time ago. But to me, it seems very, very recent. And I arrived at Oxford a rather aggressive atheist. In fact, when I read Richard Dawkins these days, I get all nostalgic because you know, I used to be like that back then. And during my first term in Oxford, you know, I had one of these mindsets. You know, I changed thinking completely. Those of you who know Greek, the Greek word for which we translate as repent, and metanoia actually means it's a radical change of mind. It's about, in effect, a mental flip whereby you used to see things like this, and now you see things like that, and that's what I experienced. And so I had this very, very difficult job of trying to reorientate my life from atheism to Christianity, thinking things through, and it still goes on today. But one of my traveling companions, as I tried to think about these things, was, of course, C.S. Lewis. I began to read him in 1974, and actually I've never stopped. So I want to try and explain to you why Lewis is so interesting. And Lewis has a panoramic vision of the Christian faith. This is one of his better known quotes. It's from the end of his essay, Is Theology Poetry? If you want to know what his answer to that question is, it all depends on what you mean by theology and what you mean by poetry. But we'll leave that to one side. This is the final sentence in the essay. I believe in Christianity as I believe the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it, I see everything else. And Lewis there is talking about the intellectual capaciousness of the Christian faith. It illuminates the landscape of reality. It helps you figure out where you are. It helps you to make sense of what you see. I want to suggest to you that Lewis really is a very good person to dialogue with. You know, when you're growing in your faith, you very often, link up with someone to help you. Sometimes they're helpful, sometimes they're perhaps not quite so helpful. But Lewis has this enormous advantage of an atheist who became a Christian, who actually has thought about his faith and is able to express himself in beautifully clear and engaging English. And I think that's one of the reasons why so many people continue to be drawn to Lewis. Some of you are probably wondering what Lewis looked like, and this is a picture that we came across in the archives of University College, Oxford. If I were to expand this by a factor of 10, it would still be completely crisp and clear, because it's a glass plate taken in April 1917. That is the entire undergraduate population of University College at that time. Lewis.
Well, you can tell. That's Lewis.
Why were there so few students there? Well, it was the First World War. And in fact, Lewis, as you probably know, was just about to go into an army training camp and then go and fight in the Great War. So it's a very touching portrait in many ways, because of that group of people there, we think only three came back. So it's a very moving picture in many ways of the destructiveness of the Great War. But what I want to explore with you is this. Why did Lewis become a Christian? He arrived at Oxford, an atheist, a very self-confident atheist, but one, I think, who was beginning to ask some questions. And these eventually would implode his atheism and lead him in a very different way. And what I want to say is that Lewis himself says in 1929, I personally think he's wrong, I think actually it was 1930, Lewis began to believe in a rather generic idea of God. Better than nothing, but, and then in 1931, he embraced Christianity. And I want to explore why each of those things happened, because I think actually they're both really interesting, and they actually help us understand why faith matters, and also why other people need to have these things explained to them, because very often you don't realize quite why faith is so exciting. What Lewis began to find in the late 1920s was, you know, he was saying, well, you know, atheism is probably right, but it is awfully dull. It doesn't do anything for my imagination. It doesn't nourish my existential roots. It kind of way leaves me untouched at the deepest level. And that, I think, is an important point. It doesn't take him to faith at all, but it does move on. And I'm going to give you two Greek words that you know Lewis was concerned about, arche and synoptical, and arche, a fundamental principle which holds all things together. Lewis was looking for something that would give intellectual stability to life, and he was also looking for, to pick up a phrase from Plato, a synoptical, a viewpoint, a place from which you could see things and make sense of them. And Lewis was convinced atheism did not provide that intellectual standpoint by which you could see and perceive things, and began to wonder what else there was. He also read some Christian writers. Now, bear in mind, Lewis was an English don at Magdalen College. Therefore, his professional business was, in effect, the English literature. And he found both George Herbert and Thomas Traherne, well-known poets, to articulate a vision of reality which seemed grounded, which seemed to match up with what he actually saw, and wondered if this was because their way of expressing themselves was grounded in something that actually made sense. And so he began to experience all kinds of concerns. And so Lewis, in effect, began to feel, look, I want to stay reasonable, but I don't want to be limited to reason. There has to be a balance between being reasonable and being captivated by a vision of something which is exciting and transformative. And many of you will recognize this paragraph from Surprised by Joy. That's Lewis's autobiography. He's reflecting on why he feels so ill at ease as an atheist. There's something wrong. What is it? And the answer is, it fails to engage with his deepest intuitions that there is more to life than what we simply see. So he writes, on the one side, a many islanded sea of poetry and myth. Myth there in the strong sense of the word, a meta-narrative, a story that captivates, that engages. On the other, glib and shallow rationalism. Nearly all that I love, that I believe to be imaginary, nearly all that I believe to be real, I thought grim and meaningless. So Lewis there is beginning to articulate this idea that the kind of scaled-down vision of reality of my atheism just doesn't do the job. It might be right, he thought, but it was profoundly uninteresting and seemed to, in effect, avoid engaging with everything that mattered to him. And so Lewis, in effect, then began to believe in God, although in a rather cognitive way, I have to say, sometime in 1929, maybe 1930. But what's really interesting is that Lewis then moved on from simply believing in God to specifically believing in Christianity. And this gentleman here, well, I think most of you will probably recognize, and that's him. I think that's taken in Merton Gardens. Those who read Merton can correct me, but it looks like it to me. But Tolkien basically had a long conversation with Lewis in September 1931. And that really changed Lewis's whole outlook on things. And it all focused on the idea of myth. Now, when I say myth, you know, again, most of us tend to say myth equals untrue story or a story woven in order to deceive. For Tolkien, a myth is something very different. In effect, it's a meta-narrative, a big picture, a grand narrative that tells us who we are, why we matter, where we're going. And it is very, very important to Tolkien, as those of you who've read his Lord of the Rings will know, but it also became very important to Lewis. Lewis loved pagan mythology. He loved ancient Greek mythology. He loved Norse mythology. And he was concerned, if I become a Christian, I've got to leave this stuff behind. Tolkien said to him, no, no. These mythologies are imperfect realizations of the big picture. They're a little bit fragmented, they're splintered, but they are inklings of truth, and Christianity tells you the full story. It gives you the full picture. It brings to fulfillment what these pagan myths were kind of way groping after. And so Lewis suddenly realized if Christianity is right, then it tells a story that makes sense of things, including all the other stories that we tell. Now, I'm emphasizing that point very heavily because for Lewis, stories came first, doctrines came later. So Lewis is saying it's the story of God, the story of Jesus of Nazareth that is primary, and doctrine are secondary reflections on the significance of this story. Those of you who've worked on the New Testament will know that fits in very well with what we now think about the New Testament. So it's a very important insight for Lewis, and it will actually have a big impact on his understanding of the relationship between imagination and reason. Why? Let me tell you. Because the story captivates your imagination. And once it's captivated your imagination, you begin to think about it. You find the mental furniture of your world beginning to be changed as the story takes hold. And that's what happened to Lewis. He found himself entering into something he didn't fully understand, but as he explored, everything began to fall into place. So obviously we need to ask, what was it that really stood out for Lewis? I'm going to single out two themes that I see as being extremely important for Lewis in the late 1930s and early 1940s, because I think they're relevant and I think they will matter to many of you here tonight as well. And that's what they are, intelligibility and coherence. Yes, they're related, but they are distinct. And again, if you go back to that quote I gave you earlier, both those themes are woven into that quote. What Lewis is saying is that Christianity helps you to make sense of things, as the sun illuminates a landscape. And if you're having difficulty understanding what Lewis is saying, you've got to see it visually, you've got to imagine. You're standing on the top of a hill, it's dark, the sun is behind you, it's rising, and as it rises, the landscape begins to get lit up, the mist begins to burn off, and you begin to see things which always were there, but you couldn't see them until the sun rose and illuminated them and took the mist away. And that's the kind of visual image Lewis is trying to develop. You can see what's there, and you can see how it all hangs together. For Lewis, the Christian faith makes sense of and positions everything else. It's like a series of snapshots which might be disconnected, but when you see the panorama, which is what Lewis is talking about, you begin to realize these snapshots actually are part of the same picture. They are connected, and that's why the cohesiveness, the theme of coherence, is so important. So intelligibility, very important theme for Lewis, the intellectual capaciousness of faith. And here's a quote from his Allegory of Love, which I think makes this point very well, although Lewis hasn't quite found his later style yet, as you can see. Medieval art, he writes, attains a unity of the highest order because it embraces the greatest diversity of subordinated detail. And what he's meaning by that is that the medieval period knew how to tell a story or depict an image which was able to bring together others as well, showing you how they were connected, how they in effect related to each other. Now, I want to say to you that there is much to the Christian faith. And these themes of intelligibility and coherence don't necessarily matter to everyone. But they matter to me, they matter to Lewis, and my guess is they matter to a lot of you as well. Because what Lewis is saying is that Christianity is intellectually defensible and intellectually vigorous and productive. And that's something you need to hear during your time here at Oxford. You do not need to have this cringing sensation that Christianity is just some kind of intellectual embarrassment. If it is, it's because you haven't understood it. And the challenge to you is to try and grasp your faith and understand what it's really all about. But it's this thing of coherence that I think we need to look at in more detail. Let's look at John Donne's Anatomy of the World. I think it was published in 1611. And it's basically at a late phase in the scientific revolution. All kinds of new scientific theories are beginning to suggest things are all over the place, that coherence is going. And he writes these lines, "'Tis all in pieces, all coherence gone." And I think that is a feeling that a lot of people have. That, you know, that there's a fragmented world out there. We can see the fragments, but they're just bits. They're not connected bits. That life is just a series of random disconnected incidents. And Lewis did not think that at all. Lewis has this very strong idea that we need to see how things hang together. And notice how Lewis tends to use visual imagery. You see this big picture of reality, and you begin to see how things hang together. And in many ways, Lewis is developing this theme in Colossians 1:17. This very famous, brilliant passage, "Christ is the image of the invisible God," and then goes on to say, "He is the guarantor and giver of coherence within reality. Christ himself is before all things, and in him all things hold together." So in other words, what Lewis is saying is things might look chaotic. They might seem to be disconnected, fragmented. But in Christ we have this vision and reassurance that things really do hang together. That there is a bigger picture. I'll come back to that later in this lecture. But certainly for Lewis that was enormously important. Now, I've emphasized that Lewis talks a lot about making sense, which he does. But some of you, I think, will say, well, look, you know, that's great. But aren't there some questions that we need to ask? And I think there are, so I'm going to go and ask them. Lewis emphasizes that we can make sense of things. However, Lewis is also clear that not everything is in focus. And he does use language which suggests that some things are still veiled in mist. Some things are still shadowy. And the point that Lewis is trying to make is that Christianity enables you to see things far more clearly than you otherwise would. But there are still areas where the sun hasn't quite penetrated, where you don't see quite as clearly as you would like. And what Lewis is really saying is, look, we're human beings, we're sinful, we're frail, we can't see things perfectly. We see things better by God's grace than we otherwise would. But it's just unrealistic to expect to see everything exactly as it is. We've got at points to acknowledge that we walk by faith, not by sight, and realize there may be things that puzzle us. But without Christ, they puzzle us even more. So I'll come back to that because there's more that needs to be said. Lewis himself, I think, did see suffering as a real issue. And those of you who've read his life story will know that the death of his wife, Joy Davidman, from cancer was a very, very difficult time for him in the late 1950s. Lewis is a very visual thinker. I know he uses arguments, but very often those arguments are linked to very powerful images which he wants to explore with us. And Lewis gives us a number of images which help us understand how he sees the Christian faith. The first of them we've looked at already, the idea of a light. The Christian faith is like a light that helps illuminate an otherwise dark reality. It enables you to find your way, to see things as they really are. And it's a very biblical image, and of course those of you who've read in the medieval period, or read, for example, Augustine of Hippo, will know this whole theme of God as the one who brings light plays an enormous important role in epistemology during that period. And of course, this university has that little motto, you know, Dominus Illuminatum Mei, the Lord is my light. It's the opening words of Psalm 27, the Lord is my light and salvation. So actually you could say there's sort of a local resonance to what Lewis is saying there. But he also uses this image, the idea of a map. You find this in Mere Christianity and a couple of other points. Well, what Lewis is saying is that Christianity gives you a map. In other words, it tries to tell you what's there, it tries to show you how these things are related to each other, and of course, it shows you how they are interconnected. And one of the points that Lewis emphasizes is that if we think of Christian doctrine as being a map, we must never confuse doctrine with faith. You know, a map is a two-dimensional representation of a vibrant, glorious, three-dimensional reality. But we need maps to get our way around. Likewise, doctrines for Lewis are, abstract representations of something that is dynamic and exciting. We need them, but never confuse the doctrine with the reality that it represents. And the third image is one that I've hinted at already, but it's a very simple one, the idea of a lens. Lewis uses a lot of glass image. For example, in Mere Christianity, a dirty window pane stopping you seeing out. But the basic theme is this: we need something we can see through. We need to be able to see more clearly. We need something to bring things into focus. Let me give you a quote from Richard Dawkins, just to achieve a bit of balance tonight. This is from his book, River Out of Eden. He says, "The universe we observe has precisely the properties we expect. If there is a bottom, no meaning, no purpose, no good, no evil, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference." Now, that's the way he sees it. I'm quite happy about that. But maybe the reason he doesn't see things is that he's using the wrong lens. And one of the things that I find in Lewis's writings is that Lewis is inviting us to judge the adequacy of a worldview by how well they bring things into focus. And that is important. Maybe Dawkins needs a lens which is able to bring things into focus. If things look fuzzy and blurred, maybe we're using the wrong lens. So let me move on now and talk about a few themes that lead on from this. I've stressed that the Christian faith offers us with a big picture view of things, a way of making sense of the whole of life. It gives a comprehensive way of looking at things. Sure, it's about the transformation of our personal existence and more. It includes the renewing of our mind. I think the challenges I see for all of us, I include myself in this, is that we need to understand our faith properly and not to be content with superficial engagement. You know, I'm trying to say to you that, you know, there is something here that really has depth, and sometimes we skim over the surface and miss it. If any of you are going to end up doing apologetics, which is in effect explaining, defending, commending the Christian faith to your friends, you need to go deep and try and understand what it is about the Christian faith that is so exciting, that would make you want to talk about with your friends. And secondly, I think a very important point, to understand why Christians believe certain things and how this affects the way we see things. In other words, I'm saying to you, we really need to ask, you know, if this is true, what difference does it make to the way we see things, to the way in which we behave? In other words, just trying to see the world through a Christian lens and thinking and acting in accordance with what we see.
And one of the points that I would make is that actually Christianity allows you to see things for what they really are. I'm afraid that I've put all male authors up to this point, so I think I need to remedy that. So I'm going to talk about Iris Murdoch for a few moments. Iris Murdoch, as you probably know, was one of a very able group of women philosophers here at Oxford in the 1940s. We had people like Philippa Foot, Elizabeth Anscombe. We had also, of course, others who keep going to this day. Mary Mixley is a very, very good example. But Iris Murdoch says, in her writings about morality, that we tend to deliberately refuse to see things the way they really are. We falsify things because that's easier for us. And what we really need is some way of seeing things as they really are, no matter how uncomfortable that might be. Now, I want to suggest to you, that's what Christianity does. It says some very uncomfortable things about human nature. It talks about sin, it talks about self-deceit, lots of things. A lot of good stuff, too, about Christ being able to change us. But one of the points I want to emphasize is that a deadly realistic understanding of human nature is essential if we're going to make sense of who we are and what we're meant to be doing. And Murdoch is saying we need to do this if we're going to be morally realistic. And she hasn't quite got the lens that allows her to say that, other than to say it needs to be done.
So let's move on and look at an example of this, which I think helps bring out the point that Lewis has in mind. The Christian faith, I'm saying, allows us to see things in a new way. In focus, lit up, sharp, not fuzzy, and appreciating them for what they really are. And I like this quote from Henry Miller. One's destination, he writes, is never a place, but rather a new way of looking at things. See, that's good, because when you see things in a different way, you behave differently towards them. If you simply see the person sitting next to you as yet another unit in an overpopulated world, you'll see them in one sense. If you see them as somebody from whom Christ died, you see them in a different way. The framework through which you see people matters profoundly. So let's look at the key point I want to make, and I'll give you an example which I think makes this rather more clearly than I've been able to do up to this point. The biblical idea is transvaluation. We see things in a new way and in a new light. So, I'm going to give you an example. This is a place called Canford School down in Dorset. It may be that one or two of you have come from there or know of it, but the interesting point is this. Before Canford School was a school, it was a country house. It used to belong to Sir Austin Henry Layard, a name, I have to say, it meant relatively little to me, but apparently he rediscovered Nineveh, which must count as something, I suppose. Probably because he spent so much time in Assyria, Layard never married and had no children. So when he died, the home was sold and taken over by what would later become Canford School. They bought the whole building and everything in it and converted it into a school. When they took the place over, they found an old stone lying in the house. Quite a funny sort of stone. I'm going to show you what it looks like. That's what it looks like. And the school assumed this was a plaster copy of something that Layard had been working on, and they didn't know what to do with it because it was an awkward shape. So in effect, it became the counter on the school tuck shop pizza place. You know, so in effect, they would cut pizza on it. And in fact, at one point, it became the school dartboard. Look very closely, you can see little pinpricks where darts missed. Then an Assyriologist visited the school and looked at it. He went straight to the British Museum and came back and told the astonished headmaster that this was a genuine panel from the throne room of that unpronounceable person. And people have been looking for it for ages because it was part of a triptych. The other two panels were known in museums. This was the third. And so, you won't be here at all surprised about this, it sold at auction that year for $11 million, which made the school very, very happy. Now, what I want you to do is just hold that analogy in your mind, okay? Look at a stone, piece of junk.
pizzas, dart boards. Incredibly expensive relic, worth millions. The stone hadn't changed. You see that point? The stone remained exactly the same. It was simply seen in a different way. In fact, it was seen for what it really was. And that's what I'm trying to get across to you. Actually, Christianity gives you this way of seeing things as they really are. It strips away illusions. It, in effect, confronts us with ourselves as we really are, the world as it is, and the good news that all of this can be changed.
So I think that is very important. How we see things is very, very important. George Herbert, who Lewis loved, actually made this point very, very clearly in a number of ways. And this is from his poem, The Elixir, from the Temple. And it's a...
You probably know this better as part of a hymn, Teach me, O God, my God and King, and all things thee to see. And there it is. Just have a look at that. A man that looks on glass, on it may stay his eye, or if he pleaseth through it pass, and then the heaven is spy.
See, what Herbert is doing there
is saying you can treat Christian faith, Christian theology, in two ways. You can look at, you can look through. And what, in effect, Herbert is saying is, look, you know, you may, if you think of Christianity as being like a glass, a window, or a lens through which you're meant to look, you can look at the window, you can look at the lens, but you're not meant to be doing that. The really important thing is to look through it and see what makes possible. And for Herbert, that's a very important thing.
And, you know, if I were to give you an illustration, unfortunately, I have to be honest here, my camera has autofocus.
And I haven't quite yet figured out how this works. So I'm going to take two pictures. This is going to be the picture of the window frame. The second picture is going to be of the garden beyond. So I'm going to make the point, window, garden. Unfortunately, the autofocus kept focusing on the window. So there is a garden beyond, please trust me. But unfortunately, my camera just like the window. So look at that, you know, focusing on the window, blurry garden beyond, that is the garden we really want to see. So Christianity is not simply a reliable set of spectacles, a reliable lens, a reliable map, a reliable whatever you want to call it. It actually is something we need to look through and see ourselves, see the world as they really are. And that's where things, I think, become really important. In many cases, I think, I initially found the idea I seemed rather puzzling and rather upsetting. And then I thought, actually, that's right, it makes sense. I mean, that's the way it is. And something can be done about this. I'm sure you all know the story about King's College in Cambridge, where there's this beautiful old mass on the altarpiece. And back in the 1970s, some vandals went in and slashed it a bit. And a friend of mine who went to see it shortly afterwards said there was a notice, handwritten notice, put beside this. It is believed this masterpiece can be restored. Now, isn't that a good way of thinking about human nature and the Christian doctrine of redemption? I think it's a very helpful way of thinking about that.
But we must move on. I want to talk now a little bit about something else. Stories and the imagination. Because one of the reasons that Lewis is so important is that he tells stories.
And Lewis realizes that the gateway to the soul is the imagination. If you want to capture somebody's heart, the best way of doing it is actually through the imagination. Now, I don't want you to panic and say, are you saying Christianity is imaginary? No. Christianity is real. It just has this ability to engage the imagination, and once it engages the imagination, it stays there, and it changes the way in which you think.
And Lewis discovered that, and Lewis knew that. And Lewis believed we need to capture the imagination of our culture, and he gave a very interesting sermon, university sermon to Mary's Church, called The Weight of Glory in 1941. In my view, it was one of the best things Lewis ever wrote. And he says, look, we are spellbound, his word,
by a secular culture, by the view what you see is what you get, that there is nothing beyond the visible and the tangible. And Lewis's point is that argument only gets you so far. What you need to do, he says, is this. You need to cast a stronger spell to break free of its influence.
Or to put this another way, you need to out-narrate
the dominant narratives of our culture. They would say there's a better story that can be told, a better way of looking at things, which is right and relevant and transformative. And Lewis does that.
And as I think you all know, he does it best in the Chronicles of Narnia. Why did Lewis write Narnia? Well, I think that there were probably several reasons.
But one of them was the sense that to engage our culture, you need to tell a story that people will pick up on, and they'll become engaged with it, and they'll stick with it. And as they read, they draw in ideas like Aslan, which in effect lodge within them and become the pegs on which they hang all kinds of later theological reflection. I think Lewis is making a very important point.
I think there are two themes that seem to me to stand out from Narnia. These are the two I think are most important. I'm sure there are others here tonight who want to add to these. First of all, Lewis is emphasizing the importance of stories. You think about it. The children go into Narnia, right? And as they go there and explore, they hear different stories about Narnia. It's the realm of the White Witch. She's in charge. It's hers. There's a different story, actually, used from the little people like Mr. Beaver. You know, this is Aslan's realm. He's not here at the moment. One day, when he comes back, everything will be changed, will be free again. And children have to work out which of these stories is right. And, you know, it's a very, very interesting exercise just to see how they begin to reflect on these stories and figure out which is right. And actually, a critical test is how trustworthy are the storytellers. It's a very interesting point. How do you know who become Christians? Because they feel that the moral calibre or the spiritual integrity of the person who's telling it actually is critically important, far more than you might imagine. So bear in mind, what Lewis is really saying is, look, our culture is telling us a story. What you see is what you get. Tough. But there's another story, which is all about us being the beloved children of a loving God who's a very special place for each of us, which our culture does not want to hear told, but Lewis says is the truth. So it's all about telling stories. A, captivating the imagination, and B, conveying intellectual content. I mean, that is really very, very important. If you think of our culture today, I talked about Tolkien, I talked about Lewis, and they are great storytellers, but I fear they're in the past. And we need somebody now who's going to tell those stories, captivate imaginations, and find a way of opening minds and hearts and imaginations to the Christian faith. But there's another point Lewis wants to make, and it's this. We become part of a bigger story.
I have to give you lots of examples to make this point, but what Lewis is saying is, look, each of the children in Narnia has their own unique individual story. And then they realize there's this bigger story of Narnia. And then they realize, actually, their story needs to become part of that bigger story. And when that happens, they become the people they really are meant to be. They move the bigger story along through their own story. And one of the points that Lewis is really trying to make is that we need to see ourselves as part of this bigger picture, a bigger story, that actually without in any way denying our individuality, we need to become part of this bigger story and figure out what we are, what we are meant to be doing. Now, I think it's a nice little challenge just to inject towards the end of this lecture. Lewis is really asking, what role do we play in a bigger story? I think it's a fair question,
and I will leave it there because I really need to wrap up to give us plenty of time for Q&A. So Lewis, I think, discovered faith in God at Oxford, and he went on to discover its intellectual power. I did the same, though in a much less interesting way. And what I want to suggest to you is actually maybe that's something you ought to think about as well. Not just seeing faith as something that you do occasionally, but actually something that is rich, is vibrant, is going to change you, it's going to give you depth, stability, existential commitment. Who are you reading? Who's going to deepen your faith? I've suggested Lewis, and actually he's quite a good companion on life's rather difficult walk. But the point I want to make is, you know, there are other people other than Lewis who might also be able to help. Lewis was an atheist when he arrived. He discovered his faith at Oxford largely through talking to other people who had thought things through. Think Tolkien saying the things to Lewis that suddenly made Lewis realize, my goodness, that makes sense. Would you have that conversation with somebody? And if not now, well, when? Because there's nothing wrong with Christian faith. The real issue is we haven't grasped it for ourselves. And so I hope you've enjoyed hearing me talk about Lewis, but I do just need to end by just needling you and saying, look, you know, we need to do this. And I think we have a very distinguished group here tonight, and maybe you could move things along in the years to come. So thank you very much indeed for listening.
Thank you, Professor McGrath. I'll field some questions now, and Kelly will bring the mic around, so if you just sort of pop your hand up, we'll make sure that the mic finds its way to you. Oh, I see, first one was in the back, very back. And then number two, was there a third one that I missed? Yeah, third, okay.
Thank you very much for such an interesting exposition from which I understood that C.S. Lewis began to have faith to realizing the fact that Christianity is a very reasonable religion or faith. So my, from what I understand, C.S. Lewis became a Christian not because he discovered the faith in Christ, but because he discovered a faith, a new world, a way of living. My question is, what about his faith in Christ? Because Christianity is not just a very reasonable religion or faith, but he's also a very personalist and existentialist, centered on Christ, religion.
Yes, well, Lewis did see Christ as being of central importance. And in fact, the biblical passage that Lewis very often picks up on is the prologue to John's Gospel. You know, the Word became flesh, we beheld his glory. Or indeed, the light, the idea of the light lightning everybody. That's a very important text for Lewis. Going back to that conversation with Tolkien of September 1931, I mean, Lewis, in a letter he wrote to his friend Arthur Greaves about a few weeks after that event, said, look, my problem was I believed in God, but I couldn't see how Jesus had any connection with God at all. And Tolkien gave Lewis a framework which suddenly enabled him to say, ah, I see how Christ fits into this completely. That in effect, the story of Jesus of Nazareth, his life, death, and resurrection, actually is the story that captivates my imagination and is a story about God. And of course, Lewis is very, very clear about, you know, the role of the incarnation in safeguarding the central identity of Jesus. And so for Lewis, Christ is always there right at the center, even though actually Lewis talks about Christ less than what you might expect. And what Lewis tends to do is to focus on the way of thinking that Christ makes possible rather than Christ himself. In other words, if Christ is the lens, Lewis is looking through Christ and talking about what he sees on the other side. But Christ is indispensable to Lewis, you're absolutely right. And he makes that very clear in a sermon he preached in a London church during the Second World War, which talks about God diving into the world in Christ to come where we are and then to bring us to where he is. Very, very moving. It's a wonderful discussion of the incarnation, the atonement, but it would take me a long time to do justice to it, but it's certainly there. Thank you.
Second question is down here.
Thank you. Speaking about the metaphor of the light, I was thinking another way that he expressed it in the Meditations in a Tool Shed. You're in a tool shed, you see a beam of light coming in. If you're looking at it, you see bits of dust floating around and think that's all there is in this darkness of the tool shed. But if you look along the light, you see there's a whole new world out there of clouds and trees and sky. And I think that was...
Exactly. It's a very powerful image. And Lewis just loves images of light. I think because they need so little explanation. You just tell what you see and it makes so much sense.
So I did have a question. Just that.
Oh, well, that's a very good comment. Thank you.
Okay. And right in the back. And then I think I saw number four, number five, six, seven.
When are our contemporary sort of Christian sort of creative geniuses, what was it then that enabled them to come to the fore? Is there anything really concerted being done to try and promote Christian storytellers and help to develop that area?
Well, I'm sure there is, but I think an awful lot more needs to be done. I think many Christian storytellers feel a little bit lonely. I think they need a lot of encouragement. They need to hug each other and meet together and share ideas. Because actually, I mean, they have a really important role to play. If you read Philip Pullman, you get a meta-narrative which takes you in one direction. We need somebody to actually tell a story that takes us in a very different direction. And the real issue, I think, is that far too many Christians just think that all you need to do is just... give a few arguments or correct a work which is clearly inadequate. Like, I'm sure you've read Dan Brown's book, The Da Vinci Code. I mean, it's a very interesting book, I think, for two reasons. One is that Christian responses to it actually have been very, very weak. They tend to be, page 63. Oh, you got the date wrong there. Oh, page 64. Got that geographical location wrong. Can't trust this guy. Whereas my problem is, when I read Dan Brown, you know, I thought to myself, you know, Da Vinci Code is absolute rubbish. I wonder what happens on the next page. And so I turn it over and say, oh, this is garbage. Oh. It's what happens next. You know, the power of the story kept you going. What we need are people who can tell stories of power and conviction, keeps you going, and work Christian themes into it. I couldn't do it, but I'm sure there are others who could. And so I have a rather pleasant task of simply saying, who is it? Get on with it, knowing it's not me.
We had one back there.
Thanks very much for the lecture. It was really wonderful. To continue on that theme of storytelling and narrative and myth-making in a positive lens, it brought me back to thinking about, like, when you're a child, how powerful, to probably most people here and most people in general, how powerful stories and narrative are in shaping you as a child and giving you the tools that you need to flourish and come into yourself in the world. And I think back to where I'm from in the States, how many seeing so many kids go through education systems and school systems, maybe going through secondary school and out to university, where the giving the full credence and power and appreciation of storytelling in an education system, at least from what I've seen, is going away a little bit. And the just the sheer value, the pure value of learning to fall in love with stories and meet them where they are and see how they reflect on you intellectually, spiritually. It seems like a lot of educators, modern educators from younger students, are increasingly throwing that away. So what would be your advice to, if you were to be in conversation with maybe a superintendent or somebody who would say, well, students don't need this, they don't need these stories to flourish and come fully into themselves. What would you say to that person?
Well, I would say to the person this. Number one, the Enlightenment is over. And the Enlightenment thought, you know, stories so yesterday. Just identify the moral principle and that's it. I don't know if you've read A.C. Grayling's book, The Good Book. It is one of the dullest books I've ever had the misfortune to read. And one of the reasons it's so dull is it's there are no stories. You know, it's just abstract analysis, and you just kind of lose your mind. But here's another point I'd want to make. When someone asks Jesus, who then is my neighbor? Does Jesus give a dictionary definition? Does he, in effect, give some sort of stipulative account of this in terms of some precise definition? No, he tells a story, you know, the parable of the Good Samaritan. I think what we need to say is that there's a law of evidence that the natural human way of thinking is to tell stories. And, I mean, it's a cliche, we live in a story-shaped world, but it's true. And very often what we do is we tell a story and we identify with it. And actually, you know, very often when you're making a point, it says it's a bit like this in The Matrix, or it's a bit like this in Pride and Prejudice, you know, where in effect you're referring to other narratives which you feel sympathy. And the problem really is that we live in a culture where very often we're being denied access to those narratives. I think that's very, very sad. But let me just say something mildly controversial, which is I don't think preachers understand enough the importance of stories. I think, you know, I've heard too many sermons where it's been conceptual analysis, abstract engagement, and very often they're commenting on biblical texts which actually tell stories. And we've lost that. I think Lewis is really pleading to go back to a story-based way of thinking about the Christian faith, thinking about ethics, you know, and also of doing apologetics. So I think there's a lot there, and it's sometimes difficult to argue this. Sometimes you have to show rather than tell. And one of the best ways of showing is simply doing a trial with a particularly younger audience, where you get one person to give an abstract analysis, another to tell a story, and ask which was the more vivid and memorable. And I'm afraid, you know, the story usually wins hands down. Thank you.
Down here, and then we had you, and then there's someone up in the corner still.
And that will do us.
And that will do us.
Thank you, Professor McGrath. My question is on the relation of Lewis to his historical context and how his writing was affected or was informed by it. So there's just some obvious instances where his writings obviously met the need of his time. For example, when your Christianity was talks, you know, in light of the war, and Narnia was about children who were affected by the war. Can you give a little bit more insight about how Lewis was or wasn't intentional about addressing the anxieties and tensions of his time, and for us also, what are the anxieties or questions that you think these storytellers would should address today in the stories that we write?
Yeah, I like that question. Let's take three works which either were written during or had their origins during the Second World War. Let's look at the Screwtape Letters, Mere Christianity, and Narnia. All of those, you know, they may have been written slightly later, but actually, you know, they were in Lewis's mind around then. All of them engage with the questions that were bubbling up in Lewis's mind and indeed in British culture at that time. And one of the paradoxes is this, you know, very often a writer who is brilliant at communicating with his or her specific niche in history becomes unintelligible to later generations because they say, we can't make sense of this. The curious thing is actually the three works I've just mentioned, which have a definite 1940s context, are still read very, very widely. And it's almost as if people filter out the cultural specifics and get what's beneath them without Lewis actually doing that at all. It's almost as if, you know, we read them and we see jokes about the Second World War, or language that dates from there, or unintelligible things, you know, which, you know, Great Scott, you know, which, I mean, no one says that anymore. But you sort of work out what it means. You can deal with that. But the paradox is that Lewis is such a good communicator that he actually carries us over those obstacles. So I think my guess is it works for Lewis. I'm not sure it might work for anybody else. But certainly, in general terms, the advice given to any Christian communicator is focus on where you are right now, you know, because you can't, if you lose specificity, you may well lose the audience. Lewis doesn't lose specificity. For some reason I don't quite understand, he seems able to kind of reach way beyond the original situations without actually rewriting what he originally said. I don't know how it is, but it's a very, very observable feature in the way in which people respond to Lewis. Thank you.
Okay, one last question in the blue shirt.
And then we might take one more, because although it's wonderful to see so many men wanting to ask questions, I'd like a female voice as well. If you want. So,
which blue shirt?
Well, blue shirt, and then we'll have some...
Which blue shirt?
Pop your hand up. Eye contact. Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, we'll just take a few female questioners, please, after this.
Oh, hi.
Thanks
very much for Simon. I enjoy that. And the storytelling is actually a feature that still exists in some cultures outside its shores. I'm just wondering, more generally, do you think C.S. Lewis could be made more cross-culturally relevant? I get a feeling that it's probably a lot of things that C.S. Lewis tried to say have an obvious relevance in this culture.
Mm.
Do you think it could be stretched?
Well, we could. I mean, if you think of Lewis, Lewis is at his peak in the 1940s. He was born in Ireland, he went to England, and then he also went to France twice, once on holiday and once to fight in the First World War. And that was it. You know, Lewis never went to America, he never went anywhere else until very late in life. And my feeling is that it's not so much that we need to make Lewis cross-cultural, it's much more that Lewis needs to act as an inspiration for somebody who's able to do the cross-cultural thing better than he could. Because I don't think really Lewis saw himself as either being able to do that or something that he needed to do, because actually Lewis was really just focusing on a very English, I use the word English advisedly, readership. And the fact that Lewis found so many readers beyond that, I think, did rather puzzle him, frankly. So I think, you know, his cross-cultural appeal, which is less than it might be, but is still quite significant, is a happy accident, because Lewis certainly didn't actually put any thought into making this happen. It just did happen. Thank you. Right, now, some final voices, and I want them female. Two, one here, one here. Right. One at the back, one at the front. Kelly, go to the back first, then come back here. Then we'll end.
You mentioned that you should be reading contemporary Christian writers. You said, who are you reading? Who would you suggest to read if you name names?
Well, I mean, there are quite a few who I think are good. And Fred Buechner, I think, is well worth reading. I think that he's difficult at times, but his heart's in the right place. You might think of a whole range of people. But my concern, basically, is that I just don't see anybody standing out as Lewis did. And so I'm happy to run a long list past you. But all I'm going to do is say, but they just don't do for me what Lewis does for me. Now, they made it very successful for others. But I'm just of the view, I'm afraid, that we really do need to just say, well, I'm sure there are some very good people around, but let's just keep going and try and find the right people. I don't think we're there yet, I'm afraid. I may be making a gross misjudgment here, but I just haven't found someone who kind of always strikes me as having the imaginative and intellectual range of Lewis, even though Lewis is actually now quite a long time ago. Our last question.
Thank you very much, Dr. McGrath. I have a question concerning the book, C.S. Lewis. Toward the end of the book, you mentioned that Lewis said apologetics was kind of dangerous to him. And sometimes he just came back home feeling alone after he successfully defended the doctrine. So one question is, what do you think of the role of apologists now? And also, how did you feel after your own encounter with Dawkins?
Well, you're quite right. I mean, Lewis tends to talk about this mostly in the 1940s, the later 1940s. There are two letters and the lecture, Christian Apologetics, he talks about this. And he just says, look, I find Christian apologetics wearying. You know, I know it needs to be done, and I know I do it quite well, but actually I don't really like doing it because I'm exhausted afterwards. And also, he says more than that. It's not that he's tired, it's that a doctrine never seems so unreal to me as when I've been defending it in public. I know exactly what he means. It's because you have good reasons for thinking it's right, but when you defend those in public, they don't come across as good as you'd hope they would. I think that's part of it. And what Lewis tends to do in his Cambridge period, from 1955 onwards, is actually not do that kind of apologetics, but more write books for Christians to help them understand their faith better. In other words, his intended audience is not people outside the church, but people in churches who need to be encouraged. And what he's doing is he's passing on the things he found encouraging to other Christian readers. But I think Lewis is a wonderful role model for a Christian apologist today, because he really engages the reason, the imagination, and also uses stories very effectively. And another feature of Lewis, which I did not talk about tonight, but probably should have, is that Lewis is very, very good at what I would call theological translation, which I mean to, in effect, take the language of the Christian faith and translate it into the ordinary, everyday language of the audience you're speaking to. And most of us, I'm afraid, don't do that very well. We keep using Christian jargon or assuming that everyone knows what these words mean, and that's not true. And Lewis, I think, realized very, very quickly he had to explain Christian ideas and bits in two ways, using images, using stories. And actually, for many preachers today, they'll still go back to Lewis, not simply for arguments for faith, but for images to use in their sermons. That very powerful image of God diving into the world. Lewis describes it so beautifully. You just feel this is brilliant. It's a very ordinary image, but Lewis makes it special because he uses it so well. So I think there's a lot to learn from Lewis, not to parrot him, simply to repeat him uncritically, but rather to look at the deep structure of his writing and say, look, here's the toolkit he's using, here's how he uses it. Now, could I take that same toolkit and use it in my own life in my own way? He's a resource, but he's also a challenge, I think.
Wonderful. Thank you, Professor McGrath. There will be wine and some snacks and so forth just as you leave the door straight across, so you're welcome to join us. And Dr. McGrath will be with us until about 9, I think, so if you didn't have a chance to ask your question, you might want to do that then. We'll see you there.
All right, I've left everything there.
That's great. Okay.